You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 1464. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. IBEW Local 1464 reminds all union members to support each other and encourage all workers to buy union and American-made products. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we'll interview Gordon Lafer about his new book, which asks what elites are doing with all their newfound power. We'll review with him the 1% solution, how corporations are remaking America one state at a time. It's a scary story. Then, we'll take a look at Kansas City's urban design from the J.C. Nichols Fountain to the Power and Light District. Big structures can define a city. We'll talk about skyscrapers and how they changed how Kansas Cityans worked. In the news, the Supreme Court comes down with a decision that favors unions. And Amazon plans mass layoffs of cashiers at Whole Foods after merger. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers, and we'll talk about Congress's attack on the NLRB. Now for the news.
Our side, June 22, 2017. Over 500 workers in the Moroccan city of Agadir have been on strike since March 2015 at Doha, part of the wealthy Bicha group. Doha workers, nearly 95% of whom are women, produce tinned fish and other products for worldwide export. The company, with the help of compliant legal and political authorities, has sought to dissolve the union, dismiss its members, criminalize and punish the strikers, and confiscate the union leader's home. Workers at the Agadir Doha plant formed a branch of the National Trade Union Center, CDT, in 2011. After a 20-day strike, local authorities, under pressure from the popular movement sweeping the region, urged the company to recognize the union. Beginning in 2014, however, management moved to have the union dissolved, imposed its own workplace delegates, and stepped up pressure on the workers. On March 6, 2015, management dismissed 51 workers, making many of whom were CDT members. This provoked a strike, which continues to this day. The company hired 500 new workers and sought punitive financial damages against active union members, including a claim of $3,500 and $10,000 in damages from the union leader, Rahman Abdallah, in response to international pressure and the strong national campaign of CDT, Doha dropped all the charges against Rahman in February 2017. The struggle for reinstatement of the 540 workers and for union rights and recognition continues. We hope that you all call on the Doha Company. It's called Bicha Doha Company. And call on them to recognize the union, reinstate the dismissed workers, and enter in good faith negotiations. The message may be in French, followed by an English translation.
PAI reports that the U.S. Supreme Court has for the first time waded into the controversial issue of organizing so-called micro-unions. Unions right to organize segments of workers at companies, not the whole companies. And it came down on the union side. The justices did so in a case called Macy's, the department store versus NLRB. The National Labor Relations Board, in an unsigned rejection of Macy's challenge to successful union organizing among fragrances and cosmetic workers in its Saugus, Massachusetts store. The High Court's vote not to hear the case upheld last year's pro-union decision by the 5th U.S. Supreme Court of Appeals in New Orleans, where Macy's took the case. That appeals decision backed both the NLRB, which for 6 years legalized the organizing of segments of workers at a company, and United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 1445, which organized the Macy's workers. The High Court's ruling is important because congressional Republicans have been screaming about the NLRB's ruling for what they derisively called micro-unions ever since the board handed it down. They also tried to overturn it legislatively, while Macy's tried to get courts to rule micro-unions were illegal. Local 1445 President Jeff Boland, who organized the workers, said they were the most militant among the Macy's workers, and the company has been trying to get them out ever since. He said Macy's tried to wear down the workers, but it hasn't succeeded. Local 1445 must undertake a new education campaign with the current cosmetics and fragrance workers, because only one quarter of the original 45 are still there. The important thing is that we have to get the workers together and let them know what they've won, he added.
Business Insider reports Amazon is planning to cut jobs at Whole Foods when it takes over the company, according to a Bloomberg report published Sunday that cited a source with knowledge of the matter. The Seattle-headquartered e-commerce giant is considering replacing Whole Foods cashiers with technology, according to the report. The job cuts could run into the thousands, given that Whole Foods employs about 90,000 people, including many on the shop floor. Amazon also intends to lower the price of Whole Foods products as part of a wider effort to make its grocery offering more appealing to people on low and middle incomes. Bloomberg isn't the only publication examining the potentially devastating consequences for Whole Foods staff. A separate opinion piece from Forbes carried the headline, quote, Amazon Whole Foods deal is bad news for store cashiers and the fight for $15 minimum wage, unquote. It's no secret that Amazon is interested in developing supermarkets that do away with people and replace them with sensors, scanners, and chips. They're called Amazon Go stores. Amazon Go stores feature technology that allows shoppers to simply walk in, grab what they want, and leave. Amazon opened its first Amazon Go test store in Seattle earlier this year. The cashierless store uses a range of sensors and a smartphone app to know what customers have purchased.
And Crane's New York Business has an article on Uber that has nothing to do with charges of sexual harassment against and stupidity of its CEO. A New York State administrative law judge decided last week that Uber should have classified three former drivers as employees, not independent contractors. Crane says it's a big deal for workers' rights advocates and could have a wider impact on employers. It confirmed a State Department of Labor ruling that let the drivers collect unemployment insurance and sets the stage for other cases involving other Uber drivers in New York. The ruling also casts uncertainty over other so-called gig economy companies whose business plans depend on classifying workers as independent contractors who are not given health or employment insurance or other benefits. This has to be making these other companies nervous, said David Weisenfeld, a professor at the Cardozo School of Law. They've always known this is a vulnerability, and when a ruling goes against Uber, they have to take a look at how they deal with their people. At the same time, he added, this is an early step toward an ultimate resolution that's going to be years away. Catherine Ruckelshaus, general counsel of the National Employment Law Project, an advocacy group, said it should really have a cascading effect on how Uber treats its workers. But she added, Uber's going to fight this at every stage. There have been similar decisions in other states, and it hasn't changed its practices. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Shaikalyn Hams, Una Noling, and I'm Judy Ansel.
It has become commonplace to note the growing political dominance of a small segment of the economic elite, the one percenters. But what are the one percenters doing with their newfound influence? For the first time, a book titled The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America, One State at a Time, provides an answer to this question. Today on the Heartland Labor Forum, I'm interviewing author of this book, Gordon Lafer. My name is Shaikalyn Hams, and I'm your host for this segment of the Heartland Labor Forum. Gordon Lafer is a professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center and is a research associate with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He has written widely on economic and jobs policies and has been called to testify as an expert witness before the United States Senate, the House of Representatives, and multiple state legislatures. In 2009 and 2010, he served as senior policy advisor for the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Education and Labor. Welcome, Gordon.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Great. And, you know, tell us how and why you started writing The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America, One State at a Time.
Well, in 2011, early 2011 was when Scott Walker in Wisconsin basically did away with union rights for public employees in that state. And a lot of people got galvanized around that. There were big protests and a lot of controversy. But then shortly after that, we started noticing similar bills popping up in all different kinds of states, doing similar things to what were done in Wisconsin and on other things like, you know, anti-minimum wage or trying to take away the right to paid sick leave. We started seeing the same bills popping up in state after state to the point where you could tell this couldn't just be coincidence. And that started getting me looking at where is all of this coming from and what are the corporate lobbies doing? You know, we know they're spending a lot more money, but what's the real policy agenda behind it? And that was really the start of the research for this book.
Great. Your book presents an overall analysis of state-level legislation in the first 5 years of Citizens United. And, you know, it captured it, the trends we would miss by looking at individual bills. In 2010, when the Supreme Court passed its Citizens United decision, America's political landscape changed. But you wrote in your book that the change wasn't as sudden as we might think. What has been happening in the past few decades and what caused such a dramatic response to corporations? What are you seeing now, Gordon?
Well, one thing, you know, there's a few things that have come together. One is that for most of America, for the two-thirds of the country that are not college-educated professionals, life has been getting slowly but steadily harder for 40 years. This is true especially for men in wages. 60% of men have seen their inflation-adjusted wages go down since the late 1970s, meaning there's now 70 million American men working for less than the equivalent of what their fathers or grandfathers made.
Wow.
And overall family income has done better and is flat, but that's only because women are working many, many, many more hours than they used to. So So the economy has gotten more and more unequal, with people at the top getting fantastically rich and everybody else slowly going backwards. And then that economic inequality has been translated into political inequality, because politics has gotten more expensive, which makes politicians more dependent on people with money. And there's been a series of legal decisions that built up over time, but really culminated in 2010 in the Citizens United case, where the Supreme Court said corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money on politics and can do it secretly.
Right.
That enabled the economic advantage of the 1% to become a political advantage as well.
Just after Citizens United was passed, Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker, he passed his budget repair bill, which eliminated public employees' right to collectively bargain. Why was this such a huge victory for ALEC and corporate interest? And can you explain to us what ALEC is?
Sure. ALEC, or ALEC, stands for the American Legislative Exchange Council. And that is the main organization through which the big corporations of the country work their state politics. There are several hundred companies that have been involved, and they're companies that all of us know. It includes Google and Amazon, the Boeing, Blue Cross Blue Shield, McDonald's, General Motors, Facebook. About a quarter of all state legislators in the country are members of ALEC. They just pay $50 a year in dues. The rest of the expenses are paid by all these corporations. Then they meet several times a year in resorts, and they meet in committees that are half legislators and half corporate lobbyists, and write bills together. Those bills are approved by a corporate board, and then they're pumped out in kind of cookie-cutter fashion in state after state, which is how we see the same bills appearing in very different states. And then the same corporations that write the laws also contribute to those candidates' political campaigns. They fund state-level think tanks to have so-called experts appear on online or write things for newspapers. And they run their own political ads on radio, TV, and social media. So it's a very well-funded, very well-coordinated campaign that is trying to change the country in 50 different state legislatures.
Okay. In your book, you pointed out that only 7% of the private sector is unionized. Yeah. So why are corporate lobbies so interested in pushing back against union power?
I think that, you know, what the people, the real economic elite, the people really at the top of the economy and trying to figure out strategy for the biggest corporations in the country, look at America as an empire in decline. And they think things are only going to get worse, not like a cliff, but kind of steadily, gradually getting worse. And what they see, what I think is true, is that long-term economic decline creates a politics that is kind of uncontrollable. There's a lot of anxiety, a lot of rage, and they're afraid about that rage being turned in their direction, understandably. And so they have a lot of different strategies for dealing with them, because for them, for the lobbyists of the Chamber of Commerce or of ALEC, the key political problem that they're trying to solve is, how do we get more money for ourselves, make the economy more unequal, make life yet harder for the majority of Americans without provoking a political backlash? And one of the things that scares them is, when times are really hard, it kind of cuts two ways about people's desire to have a union. More people want a union. There are now, depending on what measure you believe, between 20 and 50 million American workers who don't have a union and say they wish they had one in their workplace. But at the same time, people want that more because they want the security, but they're also more scared to stick their neck out to do anything to get a union. So by passing laws like so-called right-to-work bills, which are really designed to make unions financially unviable, they're trying not to win one little fight over here, okay, we'll only pay you nothing instead of the 5% raise you want or something, but to permanently wipe out the ability of workers to organize unions. I think that's the answer to the question that is kind of a puzzle. Okay, why do all these companies put a lot of money into fighting unions when, if they're not unionized and they're not really under threat of being unionized? But I think that's what it is. They're afraid that the desperation brewing in the country could lead to a rebellion against them, and they want to take away one of the main avenues through which people could rebel.
So why do you think 20 to 50 million workers are afraid of unionizing? What is fueling their fear?
For the most part, it's rational common sense, unfortunately. There are the labor laws in the United States, unfortunately, are very, very weak, and the punishments for breaking those laws by employers are very, very mild. One of the things, for instance, you know, if you, people start organizing a union, everybody wants to know, can I be fired for organizing a union?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is legally no, but in every large organizing drive of, let's say, 500 people or more, almost every drive, a few people are fired, and you have to expect that. And even though it's illegal, the penalty under law is so mild, like a few $1,000s, maybe $10,000, that most employers think, well, it's worth it. If I fire three people and I scare 500 people and I keep my workers from organizing and from having to negotiate with my own employees, I'll gladly pay $20,000, $30,000 in fines for that. So the law is so weak that it's kind of remarkable that anybody does organize a union, because it requires such bravery to do it.
Okay, let's talk about child labor laws now. Since the passage of Citizens United, child labor laws have been weakened in Idaho, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Maine. How do Republican representatives justify these shocking changes?
You know, we live in an Orwellian time where people justify things through all kinds of doublespeak. I don't know what they think in their heart of hearts. I mean, through how most of these bills have passed is there's, like in Wisconsin and in Michigan, there are laws regulating how many hours high school students can work during the school year and on school nights.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been changed, in some cases relaxed and in other cases done away with entirely. And in Michigan, the Restaurant Association came into the legislature at the height of the recession, when the unemployment in Michigan was higher than 10%, and said, restaurants can't find adults to work, essentially, we need the teenagers. And I can't imagine that could possibly have been true. It's hard to believe anybody could have really thought that was true. But what we see is, you know, a lot of manufacturers going to the places in the world where workers are the poorest and have the least political rights, going to China, going to Vietnam, going to Pakistan. And then for service sector employers who can't physically move to another country, trying to cut labor costs either by bringing in guest workers or by replacing adult workers with teenagers to make it cheaper. And I think that's really what it's being driven by. When you look at the industries that are pushing for more teenage labor, it's trying to degrade the quality of jobs so that they can pay people less and treat them in ways that adults might not put up with.
Okay, for those listeners who are now joining us, you're listening to author Gordon Lafer, who is the author of the book 1%, The 1% Solutions. Gordon, corporate interests often shun racial issues and think of them as irrelevant to their bottom line. But you have found that many corporate goals are actually linked with racial disparities. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, two of the big examples. One is that the attack on the public sector, which has taken place in many parts of the country, is almost everywhere, also ends up being an attack on the black middle class, because government jobs, especially in state and local government, are the backbone of the black middle class. If you look at where are African-American college graduates employed, a much greater share of them are employed in the government, and that's because historically there started being equal opportunity regulations in the government, in the federal government, going back to the 1940s. So hiring was just less racist in the government than it was in the private sector. The gap between black and white wages is smaller in the public sector than it is in the private sector. And so anytime there are laws that kill off public employee unions, that cut wages and benefits, or that privatize public services, in addition to whatever else it is, it also ends up being an attack on the black middle class. In addition to that, there have been a number of states where corporate lobbies have pushed and sometimes succeeded in changing the laws about your ability to sue over race or sex discrimination for being illegally fired, and made that harder. And that is something that might be motivated by racism or sexism, or might just be motivated by not wanting to be able to be held accountable to employees and not wanting to worry about employees having the right to get justice through the courts. But it plays out, certainly, in a racist and sexist way.
That's very interesting. More than just a safety net, what does unemployment insurance do for the American workforce? And how would the American workforce change without unemployment insurance?
Well, unemployment insurance, it's a good question, because it's something that most people don't think about until they need it. But it plays two kinds of very important roles. The first is obvious, which is when you're out of work, gives you a little bit of money. It's not much. In most states, it might be $300 a month, but a little bit of money to survive through the roughest times of being unemployed and hopefully hold on to your house if you have a house, hold on to your car. But the other thing it does is that it lets people be a little bit more choosy about what job they're going to take when they're unemployed. Mm-hmm. Most people, you know, if you lose your job, you look for a job that pays the same as the job that you lost. You look for a job that uses the skills that you've learned, whether in school or training or on the job. And you look for a job that is in the community where you live, where you don't have to drive 2 hours each way to work. The fact that you have even a little bit of money to see you through on unemployment insurance to help make ends meet means you might take, you know, a few more weeks or a couple of months feeling, okay, I'm not going to get a job at McDonald's right away. Because, of course, if you take the first job you get right away, you have very little time or energy left to look for a better job. And so unemployment insurance, and apart from what it does to the money in the pockets of the people who get it, it makes the labor market a little more competitive for workers. Now, what's been happening, what the corporate lobbies have been pushing, first of all, is just cuts in many, many states in the dollar value of unemployment benefits or how long you can get them for. But they've also been pushing laws like in Tennessee, the corporate lobbies got a law through that says you can look for a job that pays the same wage as the job you lost only for 3 months.
Oh.
After that, you have to take any job that is offered to you if it pays at least 3/4 of your old wage, and then it goes down to 65%. So if we had another recession like we did in 2009, 2010, just to take Tennessee's case, there would have been more than 100,000 people who were forced back to work at wages 1/3 lower than they have had lost in the jobs that they lost. And that not just has an effect for them and their family, but also lowers the wages in the labor market as a whole, because you flood the labor market with cheaper labor, and that makes it harder for anybody else to get a higher wage. So that's part of, you know, it's like a technical thing that most people don't pay attention to, but it has huge ramifications for people looking for work.
Gordon, in your book, The 1% Solution, you had some extensive conversations about education. So I wanted to ask you, after New Orleans was hit with Hurricane Katrina, the Bush administration refused to pay for reopening the public schools. Instead, it provided $45 million for charter schools to take their place. How did this affect education quality in New Orleans, and how are other states relating to this change?
In New Orleans had a bad school system before Hurricane Katrina and has a bad school system now. There's no evidence that the conversion of New Orleans public schools to charter schools has made anything better. There's some evidence that it's made things worse, but the state keeps all of its data secret, so nobody can really tell.
Oh.
Certainly nationwide, you know, what we see is charter schools being pushed very, very vigorously by big corporate interests, including Wall Street, investment banks, hedge funds, venture capitalists, when there's no evidence behind it. And part of that is to turn education into a market. And part of turning it into a market means making it not be subject to democratic control, to control by the voters or the legislature or anything like that, which means getting rid of school boards. So what happens, one of the things that happens in a place like New Orleans where all the schools are charter schools is there's no democratic control over the schools. If you're, you know, there's no school board to vote for to say we want this school to be different in this way, or we want to change something in the policy. From the point of view of people looking to make money off of schools, which is a lot of the technology industry and a lot of Wall Street investment banks, they want it to be a market and not have democratic control. And they say this directly. They say it's a problem for us. You can't sell to scale because there's thousands of little school boards everywhere, and they have ethics rules that say they can't make certain kinds of financial deals where they get rich themselves or their relatives get rich or they get some money for something else. And they want to get rid of all of that to turn it into a market. So what we have now is education policy being pushed that is, first of all, a form of education that rich people do not accept for their own children, but that they want to push on poor communities.
Yes.
And second of all, what's driving the agenda is not any theory of education, is not something that comes from teachers or parents or students or education scholars. It's something that comes from investment banks and hedge funds who look at education the same way they look at Social Security. They say, this is $500 billion of government-guaranteed funding flowing every year, and we need to get a bigger piece of it.
Okay. Gordon, we're down to 3 minutes now, and I have a few more questions. The last major question is, do you think the level of inequality in America will lead to a major revolution in America on the same scale as the French or Russian revolutions?
I really don't know. I mean, I don't think that there's any mechanism that when things get a certain amount bad, there is automatically a progressive rebellion. I think, you know, when things get hard, it can lead people either left or right. I know people who say things like, you know, I hate doctors and lawyers and insurance companies and banks, and I hate immigrants and I hate people on welfare. And there's like a lot of hate to go around, a lot of anger. And, you know, one of my fears about President Trump is I think Donald Trump essentially ran on the promise to provide decently paying jobs for people without college degrees.
Mm-hmm,
I don't think he's going to do that in numbers that matter. And as it becomes clear to people in a few years that that's not happening, I think his only move left will be to whip up even more white nationalist frenzy. I think we have to work hard to organize an alternative before that so that the anger that comes from economic hard times is not channeled into that kind of ugly right-wing direction.
Thank you, Gordon Lay, for giving us such a keen insight. I look forward to you joining us again. Listeners, you've been listening to Gordon Lafer, author of The 1% Solutions. You may purchase Gordon's book by going to www.gordonlafer.com, and Lafer is spelled L-A-F-E-R. Thank you, Gordon.
Thanks very much.
Stuff your pockets while Roman's burning. I've got a feeling that the tide is turning. I am America. One voice, united we stand.
Trans Talk, the dark side of activism. Debbie Jackson is the proud mom of a transgender daughter and an activist. She talks about the impact that activism has had on their lives on The 10th Voice, Saturday afternoon at 1.
Join us for Collaborations Live, a night of innovative original music, film, and dance, June 30th at the Historic Folly Theater. 8 unique performances pairing artists like the visually stunning Quixotic with harpist Kelvin Arsenian. VIP experience, ticket, and more information is available at kkfi.org/events. Don't miss this once-in-a-lifetime theatrical experience, June 30th at the Folly Theater. All in support of KKFI, voice of the community.
Kansas City, baby, what could I do?
There's a river of birds in my
Winona LaDuke, Indigenous Voice, on The Next Wings, Saturday at 2:30.
I got to Kansas City on a Friday. By Saturday I learned a thing or two. 'Cause up to then I didn't have an idea of what the modern world was coming to. I counted 20 gas buggies going by themselves almost every time I took a walk. And then I put my ear to a bell telephone, then a strange woman started in to talk.
What next?
Yeah, what?
What next? Gather round. Everything's up to date in Kansas City. They've gone about as far as they can go. They went and built a skyscraper 7 stories high, about as high as a building ought to grow. Everything's like a dream in Kansas City. It's better than a magic lantern show. You can turn the radiator on whenever you want some heat. With every kind of comfort, every house is all complete. You can walk to Privies in the rain and never wet your feet. They've gone about as far as they can go.
Yes, sir! They've gone about as far as they can go.
up to date in Kansas City. They've gone about as far as they can go. They got a big theater they call a burlicue. For 50 cents you can see your dandy show.
Gal?
One of the gals was fat and pink and pretty, as round above as she was round below. I could swear that she was padded from her shoulder to her heel. But later in the second act, when she begun to feel, she proved that everything she had was absolutely real. She went about as far as she could go.
Yes, sir! Went about as far as she could go!
Hello, everybody. That was Rodgers and Hammerstein's Kansas City, brought to you by the Oklahoma Male Chorus and Orchestra. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jacob White. As many of you know, summer is in full swing here in Kansas City, and travel season is upon us. Today, we offer you the opportunity to impress your parents, in-laws, children, or random passers-by with your knowledge of the history of downtown Kansas City and our beautiful, ornate skyline. Many of you might have to cross downtown on your way home from the airport, or might want to spend a day walking around, enjoying a ride on the streetcar, perhaps doing some shopping down at the city market. Maybe you work downtown or have a family member who does. Regardless, it is my hope that tonight's segment not only provides you with some fodder to impress whoever it is traveling to visit you, but also changes the way you think about downtown. Tonight, I'll be discussing four buildings in particular, talking about why they were built the way they were, and trying to understand what it meant for the people who worked in those buildings day after day as Kansas City was coming into its own as an important Midwestern city in the Jazz Age. Many of tonight's insights come from a terrific article I read recently published in the most recent Missouri Historical Review. It's called A Score of Slender Towers, Skyscraper Development in Kansas City, Missouri, 1929 to 1932. And it's by Dr. Lance Owen, who, until recently, was a teacher at UMKC. Your local library probably has a copy of the Missouri Historical Review. And of course, I would strongly recommend you go see these buildings yourself, as much of Dr. Owen's writings about them have to do with their design and their architectural novelty. That was Blind Boone's Rag Medley No. 2, according to beloved local music historian Chuck Hadditz. Blind Boone recorded that song in 1909, and it was the first song to establish Kansas City as a destination. The first building we are going to discuss is Oak Tower. During this period, it was known as the Telephone Building. In 1920, a series of mergers led to the establishment of a corporation that became known as Southwestern Bell Telephone Company. During the 1920s, Southwestern Bell hired 300 new employees in Kansas City, many of them executives and engineers who needed office space. Many other local employees were already scattered about town. The company's management decided it's high time for an expanded office setting in the downtown area to house all of their local employees. Rather than knocking down their building and starting over, the company built 8 new stories on top of the existing ones, doubling the height of the tower. The addition led to the first tiered tower on the skyline, a trend that would continue throughout the rest of the building frenzy in Jazz Age Kansas City. ¶¶
this morning, feeling bad. Thought about the good time I once have had. I'm gonna move to Kansas City. I'm gonna move to Kansas City. I'm gonna move, baby. Anybody don't like you. Everybody's friends in your face, son. Ain't no friend to you. You ought to move to Kansas City. You ought to move to Kansas City. You ought to move to Kansas City, baby. Honey, why they don't like you?
That was Kansas City Blues. According to the Fish Fry, Kansas City Blues, recorded by Jim Jackson in 1927, was so successful Jackson recorded four different versions. The professional building on 11th and Grand was built for doctors. During the early part of the 20th century, the medical profession was changing rapidly. Before the advent of electricity and technical advances in medical equipment, many doctors would do home visits or be visited at their homes. Many of the machines that doctors began using during this era were simply too big to be lugged around from house to house, and they required a stable supply of electricity. Another crucial influence on the professional building was the redefinition of the medical profession during this era. Doctors were now beginning to climb the status ladder of American society. In the major American metropolises, doctors had begun to move into large downtown office buildings in order to continue to improve upon their professional status. As Dr. Lance Owen mentions in his article, working in a downtown skyscraper made doctors feel like a part of the business scientific elite. Working alongside the executives of the major financial and utility companies as the center of a bustling city. Not sure that one really needs any introduction, but it wouldn't be summertime in Kansas City without a little bit of Little Richard. That was Little Richard's 1959 version of the famous song. The Power and Light Building remains at the heart of Kansas City's skyline to this day. Search online for photos of Kansas City, and it's a sure bet to be among the top results. At 479 feet tall, it held the honor of being the tallest building in Missouri for a long stretch of the 20th century, which is something you are welcome to rub in the face of the residents of Missouri's second city, St. Louis. The Power and Light Building, both inside and out, represented a number of trends that reshaped life for Midwesterners during the Jazz Age. In 1920, KCPL produced 175 million kilowatt hours of electricity, but by 1930, that figure was 647 million. This quadrupling of production mirrors the growing importance of electricity in the life of Midwesterners, especially middle and upper middle class people who could afford a refrigerator, dishwasher, or a vacuum cleaner. People used four times as much electricity in the 1930s as they did in 1920. Determined to put all of their employees under the same roof, KCPL management had an incredibly intricate building constructed. full of bells and whistles that email, video chat, and text messages have rendered not just obsolete, but rather arcane. Specifically, the P&L building had 5 miles of pressurized tubes installed, which passed around memos, invoices, lunch orders, and the other minutiae that make up the day-to-day life of an office worker. The Power and Light building was a perfect match for its era. The main architectural influence of the time, Art Deco, prioritized conveying energy in its buildings. And, of course, KCPL's first and foremost an energy company. The elevator lobby features sunburst patterns on its marble floors and ornately designed radiator grills. This beautiful elevator lobby in some ways set the precedent for some of Kansas City's most notable accomplishments, such as the country's first drive-through mall and the first Cineplex. I doubt the knack Kansas Cityans have for finding beauty and innovation in the most banal of things started with this elevator lobby, but it is certainly a good example. Well, that's all for today, my friends. You know, with it being so hot in Kansas City and all, we thought we'd keep it pretty light today. This has been Jacob White. I really want to thank Dr. Lance Owen for his first-rate work about the downtown buildings that construct our skyline. I would really invite you to go to your library or to try to get a copy of the Missouri Historical Review. And I'd like to thank Chuck Haddix for that little tour down songs about Kansas City that I interspersed in there so that you didn't just have to hear me drone on. So that's going to be all for today. And one last thing that we forgot to mention, want to give a shout out. I don't know if any of them are still left, but over 4,000 craftsmen were involved in building our downtown skyline between 1929 and 1932. And I think we ought to remember them and remember the great service that they gave to us and the beautiful skyline they built for us. And so with that, go Royals and keep cool this summer.
Okay, and this is Judy Ansel with this week's feature, Washington Window on Workers. And with me on the phone from Washington, D.C. is Mark Grunberg of PAI News Service. Welcome to the show, Mark. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks very much, Judy. Good evening, everybody.
We're going to talk about this assault on labor law that is coming out of the Republican-controlled House Education and Workforce Committee. There's several bills that you wrote about last week, Mark. And I have to say, when I read this article, I was like just really depressed. This is some of the most mean-spirited, let's erase the last 80 years of labor law I have seen. It's amazing. So tell us about it. Who's behind
it's really
this?
It's very amazing. To set the scene, that committee, which I think includes one of the congressmen congressman from Kansas City in, on the minority side.
Who is that?
On the Democratic side. I think he's. Are you talking about Emanuel Cleaver? Yeah, I think it might be. I think it might be Cleaver.
Okay, I didn't realize he's on that work.
It's a very ideological committee on the Republican side. They want to take people back to the Roaring Twenties, or even worse, to the Gilded Age. And so they've been trying for the last couple of years to undo various pieces of labor law, which protects, and let's make this point, protects all workers, not just union workers, all workers. And now, with the Republicans in the White House and Republican majorities on both sides of the Hill, they've put all their ideas together in several pieces of legislation and are trying to enact them all at once. And they're bad. They are very bad. They're very depressing. The one pro-union witness there, Guarino Calamine, who is the general counsel for the communications workers, he summarized it very well. These bills are chock full of malicious intent to render recognition elections absurdly undemocratic, strip workers of rights, take control of unions away from their members, drain union treasuries, and otherwise destroy labor unions. Quote.
Yeah, really. So yeah. Let's talk about the specific bills. The first one you mentioned is House Bill 2776, sponsored by Representative Denny Wahlberg from Michigan. What's that one about?
That one basically would put up all the old roadblocks that employers used to be able to use to try to stop union elections from recognition elections from even occurring, never mind whether the union won or not. You know, the employers, before the NLRB got around to acting under the Obama administration, the employers could throw all sorts of roadblocks in the way. Question who should be in the unit, how the vote should be conducted, when the vote should be conducted, where the observers should be, et cetera. You know, where people could even campaign, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that, you know, would delay things. They hope to wear workers down. And remember, it's workers trying to exercise their right to organize in their own defense for their own good, and yet businesses were able to basically wear them down through all these roadblocks. Wahlberg's bill would restore them. In so many words.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that when the National Labor Relations Act was passed back in 1935, it gave employers absolutely no say at all. There was no free speech for employers because the decision to form a union is the worker's decision. It's not the employer's decision.
It's not supposed to be the employer's decision.
Yeah,
correct.
And then it was Taft-Hartley, which gave the employers this right to free speech, which instituted all these union-busting campaigns during elections.
Right.
And, you know, it's been proven over and over again that the longer the period is between the union's filing for a certification election and the actual election, the more that favors employers, because not only do they wear workers down, they intimidate the heck out of them. And so what this guy Wahlberg wants to do is make sure that there's no way you can have a speedy election. And that's just so biased against the rights of the people who this bill was originally for. I find it just absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, the all three of them are outrageous.
So what's the second one?
You've got another bill.
Yeah, H.R. 2775.
Right now. This is by Congressman Joe Wilson of South Carolina. If the name sounds familiar to you folks, this is the guy who, when President Obama stood up and talked about the health care bill, this is the nut who yelled out, "You lie," in the middle of the speech.
Okay, I remember him.
Yeah. This guy, right now, when a union does say, okay, we have enough support to call for an election, the employer is supposed to turn over a list of names of eligible people.
It's called the Excelsior list.
It's called the Excelsior list. It used to be just names and addresses. Then the NLRB said, okay, wait a minute, names and addresses aren't good enough anymore. So they added telephone numbers and email addresses. Well, Wilson wants to roll that back to just names. and one other way of identification that the worker can pick. And, as if that wasn't bad enough, even before the expansion of what information should be turned over, the point was everybody who was eligible to vote should be on the Excelsior list. Wilson's bill says to the worker, oh, you can tell the boss, I don't want to be on the list in the first place. Third, and this is the fun part, that Wilson's bill also says that the employer doesn't have to turn over that list, regardless of how much or how little is on it, until basically a week, up to a week before the election.
Oh, my gosh.
Literally, you could turn it over the night before.
You know, these guys, I mean, this is how you have elections in third world dictatorships. You know,
exactly.
These are the kinds of rules where it's so rigged that there's no way you could have any kind of democracy. Okay, we only have a couple more minutes. Tell us about H.R. 2723, the so-called Employee Rights Act.
Yeah, that's the third part of the rigging. So that one comes up, basically follows up the election itself. It says in so many words that in order to win the election, right now, if it's a union election, when it ever occurs, the union can win it by having a majority of the people casting ballots, or the majority of votes, in other words. So if you have 50 voters and 30 of them vote, and it comes out 20-10 for the union, then the union wins. This bill would say if you have 50 voters, you got to have 26 votes, an absolute majority of everybody, in order to win.
So even the people who could care less and don't vote.
Right. Anybody who doesn't vote is counted as a no.
Right. This is the rule they have under the Railway Labor Act, which is the principal reason why so few unions in the transportation industry have been formed in the last so many years.
Right. Exactly. This is also what we mean by rigged elections. If you were to institute that rule where you had to have an absolute majority of all the voters in a district in order to win your congressional seat, the number of people in the United States House of Representatives would be zero.
Yeah, right. It would have saved us from Trump, too. Okay, well, we're out of time. How much chance is there that these turkeys are going to pass?
These turkeys will probably get out of the committee on party line votes, although there's no schedule for them right now. In the past, Speakers Boehner and Ryan didn't even bring them up to the floor. They knew they were so controversial. But this time, there's a Republican in the White House.
Yeah.
So you might very well see these turkeys wind up on the House floor, zip through the House, and then, in all likelihood, you'll see a Senate filibuster against them.
Right. Okay, thanks very much, Mark. We'll talk to you next month. We've been talking to Mark Grunberg from PAI News Service in Washington, D.C.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for June 22nd. Living on the Edge, Story Slam, sponsored by Stand Up Kansas City. That's going on now at Westport Flea Market, the Buffalo Room, 817 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri, 64111. UAW Local 31, 3rd Annual Classic Car Cruise, Saturday, June 24th, 1 to 5 p.m. Coalition of Black Trade Unionists and A. Philip Randolph Institute Community Health and Awareness Fair, Saturday, July 15th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Laborers Union, 7820 Prospect, KCMO, Walnut Grove Neighborhood Association is also co-sponsor. Midwest School for Women Workers, Sunday, July 16th, through Thursday, July 20th. Registration extended until June 23rd, tomorrow. For a brochure, go to MidwestWomenWorkers.org. SEIU Healthcare Demonstration to Support a Fair Contract, Thursday, July 20th, 2 to 4 p.m., Research Hospital.
And that's it for tonight's show. You can find our calendar, our archive shows, and our upcoming schedule at our webpage at HeartlandLaborForum.org. And if any of you saw the article about the suspension of the operations of the Worker Education and Labor Studies program at UMKC, you can make your opinion heard by calling the chancellor at UMKC, but that is not going to interfere with the continuation of the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to be an all-volunteer show, and we will continue to broadcast. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to have Peter Moskowitz in with his book called How to Kill a City. It's all about TIFFs and various, it's actually all about gentrification. And we'll have Jonathan Rosenblum with his new book called Beyond $15. Thanks to our engineer, Lincoln Dreyer, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.